Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Foster Inclusion Podcast, and thank you so much for joining me. I'm your host, Saida Gomez-Fleury. In this episode, I discuss financial inclusion in Ethiopia and Eritrea with Cal Kassa of Bitcoin Burr and Bitcoin NACFA. I first became aware of Cal in an article called Check Your Financial Privilege by Alex Gladstein for Bitcoin Magazine. Cal is in the media business and a daily user of Bitcoin using the Lightning Network. After studying at Chapman University, he returned to his native Ethiopia, where he began his career in business advisory for privatization clients making investments into the country. Today, Cal manages various Bitcoin-centric initiatives between San Jose, Austin, and Addis Ababa. Bitcoin Burr and Bitcoin NACFA have actually received millions of Satoshis in donations from NFL player Russell Okung, who happens to share the same birthday as my daughter, day, not year, and Ray Youssef, CEO of Paxful. Join us for this entertaining look into financial inclusion and how the Lightning Network facilitates small cross-border transactions. It is so nice to, meet you again virtually.
Well, pleasure is all mine. Thank you for, taking interest in the story and then, taking time to do this call. So,
yeah, I read about you the first time in the Alex Gladstein article, Check Your Financial Privilege. And then I started to follow you on Twitter. And then I joined your Telegram groups, Bitcoin Burr. How do I pronounce it again?
Bitcoin Burr. So you're saying it right.
Bitcoin Burr and Bitcoin NACFA. So before we get to your projects, though, I want you to share a little bit about you to our listeners. So what's your name? Where were you born? And where do you live?
Sure. So my name is Cal. I go on Twitter and things like this by Cal Kassa. And I live in Addis Ababa. It's the capital of Ethiopia. And currently I'm in Austin, Texas.
Okay, so you still live in Addis, but you're in Austin.
I'm a little bit everywhere right now. but yeah, I think, so right now work is here and all my things are there. So going back and forth.
You're juggling. So from a cultural perspective, what are some of the similarities or differences between life in Addis and life in Austin?
The biggest difference is, of course, the wealth and the development and all of the tools that I have here in the United States. For example, if I wanted to buy a, small device for work or, some computer equipment or any kind of a software subscription for either my work or my personal life. In the States, it's quite easy to do, right?
Yeah.
Dollars, debit card, credit card, you're good. If I was in Ethiopia, because I'm a diaspora, I would get a certain privileges. But for the most part, most people don't have those linkages. They don't have those tools. So they don't have dollars. And if it's like a physical item, right? Like I bought a little, iPad, right? It's an Apple product.
Yeah.
And so it was like quite cheap, right? I mean, a few $100, $600 or $700, got a brand new one, right? If I was in Ethiopia, that same product would be probably the equivalent of $1,000 or $1,200, right? So.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, there's a 2x markup. So it's
so sorry, what was the cost of your iPad in the US?
In the US, so the iPad was 700 and then some additional pieces and things like that. But for those reasons, working here is a lot easier. And also to just bring it back to maybe some things that do matter, which are, you know, kind of the your personal life, right? How you
feel
in the morning, right? And kind of those social linkages, right? That maybe don't have anything to do with business. For me, I think those linkages are strongest in Ethiopia. I've been living there for the past 8 years now, and it's become home. It's where I've built my little community, and Ethiopia will always be home, but you know, when work calls, I might have to come to the United States some.
Yeah, I totally relate. When I was, I did a trek in Ethiopia, 2 weeks. I trekked the Simien Mountains with a group, and it was such a feeling that I've never felt before. For example, people on the street would call me Habesha. Am I pronouncing it right? And so long as I didn't speak or reveal sort of any of my cultural background, I felt like I blended right in, and I really did feel at home. It was like, it was such a beautiful, beautiful experience. And when I returned back, I thought, wow, we're really cold in Western countries. Like, the sense of community is not at all the same. So I hear totally what you're saying.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, those are the things I miss. And even within the, you know, because I see that you have a very kind of cosmopolitan background and you've lived in. What are the exact countries that you've lived in and kind of cultures that you've been exposed to?
So I was born and raised in Canada, in Toronto. My family is from Trinidad and Tobago. I lived in Trinidad for 2 years as a baby, so I don't have strong memories. And then in my third year of university, I lived in France. I lived, studied, and worked part-time in France. I returned to Canada, and then I moved to Switzerland in 2008. So I've lived in a few different cultures, and I've traveled to, like, I don't know, maybe 30 or so different countries, different languages. And I've been lucky enough to have traveled where I've spent, like, 2 weeks or more in different regions for professional reasons and also for, like, in a capacity that allowed me to not be like a 100% tourist, but allowed me to sort of like interact with people and be exposed to local culture.
No, I mean, I think that, so you've been to, you know, probably 30 to, you know, different countries and interacted with probably dozens of those cultures. You know, for me, it's, you know, sometimes because I did grow up in California, I went to, you know, public schools and you know, all throughout my youth, you know, I went to Chapman University. I studied political science.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, it looking back.
You're smart.
I'm not really. I just kind of, you know, I passed. But I really enjoyed my classes, and I took really interesting. So I was a political science major, but you know, the way I ended up taking my classes, you know, a lot of you know, religion and theology, and as well as business classes, entrepreneurship, and then big film school. So I would sneak into their like late night projects and like programs, and they had all of these, you know, amazing kind of lectures. So, you know, I kind of just, you know, built my I guess career, if we want to talk. So yeah, I'm what questions might you have for me? I'm sorry, I'm kind of like talking about myself.
No worries. We're just I guess getting warmed up. But just really quickly, I want to touch a little bit more on Ethiopia before moving on to your projects, because I think that it would be of service to listeners to get more insight into Ethiopia, its culture. You mentioned studying religion, its religion, and the impact it's had, in my personal opinion, on the world. Can you give us sort of a snapshot of Ethiopian history and culture and some of the sites that tourists can see?
Sure. So, you know, it's great that you've had that experience to come out to Ethiopia and do the trek. Ethiopia has a very long kind of religious history and a long kind of biblical history. 5,000 years, you can see Ethiopia really take shape as a state and as a culture, and we can, you know, really draw our lineage to, I think it's called Dumt, and some of those early kind of civilizations. And Ethiopia, you know, like I said, it's world, I think UNESCO, a UN program, has all of these World Heritage sites and programs. I want to say at least 7, if not 9, are in Ethiopia.
Yeah. Yep.
There's a lot to see, the lalabellas and you know, the different castles and the churches made out of, you know, rock and all of this. So
yeah.
And then if I always, you know, joke with my friends, if I could have any job in the world, it would be the Minister of Tourism.
Yeah.
It would be the most amazing job. Afar, you have these like salt flats, the Danakil,
yeah,
and some of the hottest little forms, and salt comes from there. So it's, And then, when you go down south, it becomes more lush. And we share a border with Kenya. There's a lot of resource. There's a lot going on. It's beautiful. It's young, but we're still broke. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's totally. That's the challenge here, you know?
That's the challenge. And actually, I think, is it bur means salt, right?
So bur actually means silver.
Silver, okay.
That's what it directly translates to, but bur has become kind of our I guess you'd say colloquial money, right? So that's how we refer to money, or at least money in paper form. And then one grade above bur, the silver coin, would be the work. Work is gold. So
okay.
And it was during the 40s, 50s, 60s, a lot of these currencies were actually backed by silver and gold. So that's how the term originates, right? It's only in like recent history that, you know, either, you know, most of the standard of kind of gold kept in the different forts and then treasuries around the world have kind of disappeared, or they're not there altogether, you know?
And for Ethiopia, does that coincide with Bretton Woods in 1971, or is that a separate incident?
So 71, when you had Nixon take U.S. Off the gold standard, it affected everyone. And then, you know, looking back into some of the other histories, and World War II is a big equation in this, right? A lot of gold is shifting, to say the least, right? There's an entire history as to the Jewish experience, and the gold that was stolen from them, right? Like they were, right? I heard these horrible stories of, and I think a lot of that gold was being processed in Switzerland. So there's interesting history there too. The Ethiopian bur, I think has come to mean many things now. Not just the silver coin, but also the paper currency.
The paper currency.
Which is worth less and less, you know?
Which is worth, yes, exactly. And because I think there's a connection in my mind, and you'll obviously correct me, between like small to mid-sized businesses, tourism, and the valuation of the currency. And the reason I said this is that, so in my experience, we had local guides, we were told to pay them in US dollars and not in local currencies. And from my understanding, a lot of Ethiopians run small to mid-sized businesses. Is this kind of what it looks like, or is there something more?
No, absolutely. You got it. I mean, most of if you look at Ethiopia as a whole, about 70% is still rural. So out in the countryside, most likely, you know, farming or something to do with agriculture. And then you have the cities, which aren't really, there are many now, but they don't have a large population. It's really Addis Ababa where the commerce and the population is. So, and in Addis Ababa, most of the people tend to be, traders and merchants, at least judging from the Addis Ababa Chamber of Commerce and some of those members of that association, a large majority of them are traders. They're agents, often brokers or logistics or something like that. That tends to be a lot of the economy.
Yeah. So I've read about remittances in many different countries. What does that look like in Ethiopia? Like, is that a significant contributor to GDP as well?
So, yes, I think you had in your you sent me some material that looked at remittance across different data sets.
Yeah.
I think the World Banks or some of those international organizations saying a remittance is, you know, half a billion to 1 billion a year. And then Ethiopia and the National Ethiopian Bank and some of the statistical analysis on the Ethiopian side say, 3 to 5 billion, right? And so I look at that and I say, I'm most likely gonna side towards the Ethiopians. If the Ethiopians, and so then the natural question goes, does that $5 billion, right, in remittance, where is it coming from? And, does it add value to Ethiopia? And usually it's coming through like a World Remit and things like that. But also, are there illicit markets or like black markets involved?
Yeah, informal channels was the term used.
and my humble answer would be probably, and probably a vast majority. And also I want to note here, I don't regard the son in America sending his parents $200 for the holiday. I don't consider that a crime or illicit or shady or anything.
Yeah.
Chooses to do that, and they want to get a better black market price for it. I feel like I could look the other way. What I often see happening is the banking, executives in Ethiopia are involved in this at a much larger pace, right? And it's almost legitimized, right? And so I've seen this with my eyes, and I see that it was almost systematic, right? On a monthly basis, boom, 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 boom. They're stealing from themselves, right? Because those are dollars that could have gone into government coffers and used for good things, right? Importing medical goods and X, Y, and Z. Instead, they're importing other things, right? And just the most profitable thing, right? It doesn't matter what it is. And so, because I want to be very cautious as to if I say that there's a wrong, I don't want to throw everybody in one bucket,
Of course.
So remittance is an interesting discussion in itself. That's an entire chapter.
Most definitely. And of course, from my perspective, I think of that because I think that it's a very strong use case for Bitcoin. I've spoken to people from various regions who have all said that the remittance market is very important with respect to Bitcoin. But I'd like to know how you actually became involved in Bitcoin. One, and then two, after that, what inspired you to create Bitcoin Burr and Bitcoin Nakfa?
Sure. So the first question was, what got me in it, right?
Yeah.
So first time I heard about Bitcoin was 2000, 13, my college roommate was mining it. And I thought it was like, you know, internet money, and it was kind of cool. But also I remember he paid more in energy at the end of the month, because we all split the bill and all of that. Because PC was taking up a lot of energy to mine it. And I just thought it was a cool thing. I thought it was an alternative investment. Like, that's, you know, magic internet money. Really cool. Like, let me focus on some real money, though. You know what I mean? Yeah. So that was my attitude to it. And then years went by, right? And so I ended up in Ethiopia. I started working for Grant Thornton, a global advisory firm. They do a lot of kind of transaction advisory, tax, audit. And, you know, I was doing a lot of their kind of business development and proposal writing and things like that. And so, again, I was working kind of that fiat world, you know?
Yeah.
Where it's very interesting, right? There's a lot of money moving around.
Yeah, it's fast.
And you know exactly how those worlds operate. And I think we kind of share a similar maybe experience around, you know? But so again, you know, Bitcoin wasn't on my radar. And then early 2020, so, last year, I started hearing about it in Ethiopia. Some graphic designers that I work with were using it. They were saying, hey, look, it's much easier. Can you, you know, oh, you're American, aren't you? Like, go figure it out. Like, try, you know? Yeah. And I'm like, stuck being the middleman, you know what I mean? And so, but again, it was something somebody else liked, right? I didn't look into it. And then I actually had to leave Ethiopia on like short notice. So there was an assassination in Ethiopia.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, and it turned into this mess, right? And the internet was down for 3 weeks. And
3 weeks.
Yeah, there was SMS and then there was phone call. So, on the fifth day, I left. Yeah,
so, I'm out. Sorry.
And I had a backpack, and I had a boombox, because my brother, I have two brothers, and the one in Ethiopia. He runs a small business. He owns a bar.
And, yeah.
Well, now he has a bar and restaurant. So he says, oh, take my old stereo. It's like this big Bose boombox thing. He's like, take it. I'm like, why? And he's like, oh, you need to fix it and then bring it back to me. I'll fix it. And because the parts are expensive. It's like, you know, three times the price.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
So I'm like, okay, no worries. So I had my backpack, I had my laptop, I had his stereo boombox. I had no...
You're such a good brother.
I'm still wearing random clothes that I find. And like, so I leave all my things. I'm like, I'll, I'm just going to get some internet and I'll be right back, you know? And yeah, it's been almost a year now. Yeah, I haven't... I still have, you know, my brother's boombox. You know, I'll go back any day now, but yeah.
Do you take like pictures and send them to him of his boombox?
He's forgotten about it. He'll probably be surprised if I bring it back.
So that was your sort of like parlay into Bitcoin. And it's funny that it's like your associates in Ethiopia that brought you to it. You'd been exposed to it. And again, it's this practical, pragmatic case that like brings you back into it. So then from there, what led to the creation of Bitcoin Burr and Bitcoin Nakfa?
Well, I mean, even before I get to the creation, I mean, you know, on that point, you know, so you have to imagine you're, so I left Addis Ababa in a rush, right? And so I'm grabbing my things. I'm, you know, where's my, you know, hard drive? You know, the things that matter, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, where's my money, right? So
yeah.
I remember going and waiting at the bank. I normally bank with Bank of Abyssinia. but for some reason their like network was doing weird things, like they were closed pretty much. And so I just remember, and so because dollars are illegal in Ethiopia, right? I can't really have dollars on me, you know? So I have to like request a bank to give me just a few hundred dollars to travel.
Wow. Right?
And usually they set those limits or those maximums at around $300, right? They might scoot you up like $500. Yeah. And it's like, yeah, exactly. So you're, and this is your own money. Like you have it and you just can't take it out.
So hold on, just a little pause. How do you buy like a plane ticket and stuff? Do you have credit cards or?
So me, fortunately, I have, you know, family and friends, and I'm an American diaspora, so I can have those cards available.
Yeah.
So it's a lot easier for me. And that's also why, you know, I don't keep a lot of money in Ethiopia. Why would I, right?
Yeah, exactly.
If I have the privilege to keep it in America where it's not going to devalue, where I can move it as freely as semi-freely as I want, right? I'm going to do something. So yeah, these are things. And I think, you know, on your note of financial, or I guess it's kind of inclusion, right?
Yeah.
I would say the best way to get to that inclusion is to have freedom of money and having that financial freedom to own dollars if you want to, Bitcoin if you want to, what have you.
Yeah.
And it was at that time where it became really real for me, you know, because it's not like I can take gold across the border, right? Like the airport just wouldn't allow that, you know. So
shove it in the boombox, like take all the parts out and just shove it in.
Boombox, you know, bringing it back into Ethiopia, they're going to tax me. And so, you know, so this there's a mega bull called Michael Saylor. I'm sure you.
Oh yes, of course, yeah.
So he's I think put everyone's wealth in that fund, which is great. He's taught a lot of people about Bitcoin, but he talks about a story where he was trying to move a few million out of I think it was like Argentina or Brazil or a country in South America, and he's calling his advisor. He's like, can you like put it on a mule and get it out of there? Like, no, like get it in gold and like smuggle it out. No, he's like, we can't wire it. No. And then he's like, can we buy yachts and like expensive yachts, right? And sail the yachts to like the, you know, some yard abroad. And that didn't work either. So, he, you know, of course he has millions and millions that he's trying to move around, and I have, you know, a very humble, but it's that very same thing that like got me into Bitcoin. I'm just like, you know what? I need to have access to my money and custody over it at any time. And that's why the Bitcoin thesis makes sense. You know, if you're super rich, then you want to store a value, you know, you have enough property and, you know, your capital is just depreciating, right? So you need to put it somewhere. And so Bitcoin is great. Like that's why all of these Michael Saylors have gone into it. I feel like for me, it's, I have to pay a graphic designer. I owe him $50. Western Union's going to charge me, $50 to move that 50, right? So it's like, it doesn't make sense to even have small contracts anymore, you know?
Totally.
Payments. So Bitcoin for me is a complete like utility. I also even use it as a unit of account, which like people don't do because it's so volatile. People talk about dollar, but like, no, I usually quote things in Satoshi.
Nice.
You know, and in Bitcoin. And so, yeah, I've pegged my life to, or at least my work life to Bitcoin. It's easier.
That's amazing. That is amazing. I'm not, for me, it's still a store of value. Like, I stack as frequently as I can. Again, I'm humble as well. And I've made a few payments in Bitcoin. I donated to bitcoin.org. Although with this recent, judgment involving Fakitoshi, I'm not sure that I will make any further donations. Did you hear about that?
Nope. What's going on?
No. I forget the name of the current host of Bitcoin.org, I think. I have to check the names, but was taken to court by Craig Wright, the gentleman claiming to be the real Satoshi, and apparently because, yeah, there's a whole bunch of...
What happened? I'm sorry.
Well, apparently, I should probably check, read again before I say too much, but apparently because, I think his name is Cobra, his Twitter handle is Cobra, because he didn't want to reveal his real identity or something, the case was basically sided in favor of Craig Wright in the UK court. So I think Bitcoin.org may no longer be allowed to host the white paper, if I have the details right, in the UK.
Fair, but you know, the thing, I think I host the white paper, like on
some. Yeah, I know, it's the internet, like.
Try to ban it, good luck, like, you know, it's gonna be.
Yeah, but bitcoin.org is like a very symbolic website, so. But I made a donation there, and I donated to Signal, I think, in Bitcoin, and I invested in like the solar panel project in Bitcoin. Like, I have millions. Like, I donated Satoshis. But for the most part, I hodl. I'm just like, with my family, I've persuaded my husband that it's a great store of value, that it's worth it to just buy some and just let it sit there and wait for 10 years. Low time preference.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. And, you know, and also it's you know, it'd be, you know, you and I think we have, you know, the ability to have little, you know, credit cards and debit cards and things.
Yeah.
Like that. And our PayPal and Venmo works all the same. And so, you know, I think for us, you're right. A store of value makes the most sense, you know, but I know a lot of people where the best way to send money to someone. You know what I mean?
It is definitely. And Bitcoin Beach in El Salvador and the fact that it's legal tender there now, to me, is just remarkable. Like, I'm still stuck in the phase where I'm just amazed that this thing that is totally decentralized, it has no leader whatsoever, is influencing so many people across so many cultures. For me, that is one of the most amazing accomplishments ever. If you think of countries that have adopted the US dollar, if you think of other things that have been sort of forced upon people because they had no bargaining power, because they needed these things in order to trade, and you consider this like this piece of software that who knows who created it, you know? Over the span of what, like 12 years now, it has just expanded incredibly. Like, I find it to be one of the most fascinating things ever.
Absolutely. And yeah, it's you know, I think you have probably different milestones or cornerstones in history. You know, we had the printing press or, you know, cars or planes or space travel, right? And so that one's pretty cool. And so all of these things, I think, grow us differently as a species, right? Or you would hope all of us at the same time, right?
Yeah, well.
And I think, so Bitcoin stands firmly in that. It's an interesting thing. Where did it come from, right? Like, ooh. I remember at some point I was talking to my mother about this, right? We would have coffee. And we would just talk, and she would have all of these questions. She's like, "So where is it?" Right? I'm like,
I love it.
It's just kind of there, you know. Like it's a network of that network of them talking to each other. So she'll kind of look up and she'll be like, "Okay." And so she's now, you know, can almost visualize it. She understands it's non-inflationary. There's only 21 million. She helped me translate, you know, inflation into Gishpat, you know, Yawaga Gishpat, that's inflation, right?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think it's a very easy concept for anyone to understand. And somebody to say they don't understand it, I mean, it's very, it cuts at everyone's life, right? I mean,
yeah,
there's often a lot of confusion as to what the ills of the world are, right?
And yeah,
it's really just expensive. You know, like that's the only problem. Like, you know, people just can't eat, you know, like there's a reason why, you know, productivity grows, right? Growth and all of these indicators grow, but the standard of life, and, you know, I think at least some economies are living less than previous generations. So, you know, we need to get better in terms of almost everything, you know?
Yeah.
So, and as the Bitcoin thesis goes, you fix, you know, the money, you fix the world, you know?
And yeah, so exactly.
If you can prescribe appropriate value that's not debased, where Western Union doesn't take a cut, you know?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I'm throwing brand names around, but, you know, that's because, you know, I have to really go deal with these institutions, you know?
And yeah.
It's not the best customer, you know. I'm not satisfied, you know, paying 14%, paying 7%, you know, to move my money, you know. It's a thing that any African, any Ethiopian, any Eritrean can understand. You know, my mother actually knows more than me on this subject. I was like, oh, did you know about inflation? She's like, yeah, I know.
Yeah.
She remembers a time when that paper currency was actually, you know, worth the actual silver or gold, right? That was printed on it. And so she was like, yeah, like that was, you know, the thing. And even until, you know, recent history, the Ethiopian birr was very strong, right?
Yeah.
And these past, you know, few decades, I think we've seen ourselves go deeper into debt. And as a state, it unfortunately, it steps into your sovereignty, and you're not allowed, you can't make decisions on your own interest. You have to fall in line with whatever your debtors say is the line, you know?
Yeah.
On an individual basis, of course, it gives you like FU money, you know? Then from a state perspective too, like look at the states that have caught up, like El Salvador, you know, very cool. But the first one to do it, or one of the first ones, was Norway, you know. They established hundreds or thousands of Bitcoin in their sovereign wealth fund, you know, just a rainy day fund, you know. And so, I think, you know, the Bitcoin thesis in Africa is going to be an easy thing to share, really, because people like my mother understand it so well.
Yeah, the utility is very present. And, you know, like I read as much as I possibly can. And I find that those like economists or high ranking government authorities who criticize Bitcoin, firstly, I wonder if they've actually like, you know, if they even have a wallet, like if they've tried using the Lightning Network, I wonder what their exposure is to it really is. And I also wonder if they realize how, I would say, condescending they are to people like your mother, like people who have experience, firsthand sort of frontline experience, and know exactly what's going on. Like, they don't need a published report. They don't need to hear statistics to understand that what they could buy with one unit, you know, 30 years ago, they can no longer buy. Like, it now costs seven times that much, for example. I find that we have a tendency to be a little arrogant.
Yeah, and overcomplicate things.
Yeah.
You know, so I, after some digging, I learned that the Commercial Bank of Ethiopia does have a very good understanding of Bitcoin. They had an entire report about 3 or 4 years ago. They just acted on it, right? So they just haven't done anything about it. And so I am kind of begging and challenging, and you've seen me on the Telegram groups, and it leads us into, you know, Bitcoin Burr and Bitcoin Nakba. But essentially, they are me doing as much as I can to, like, I guess, draw attention to it, you know, because I've been doing it with, you know, 20, 30, right, just within my little commerce activities, right? I work in media and marketing, and I have to pay people, so, you know. So what I've done for my own work, right, and I've been very fortunate, like, I'm happy with you know, my clients and things like this, and if only more Ethiopians knew about this, right, they can have the same privileges that I, you know, they don't need a Credit Suisse account, they don't need a Bank of America, they purely by having a Lightning wallet or a Bitcoin wallet, they can work in one of these, you know, remote digital ecosystems. You know, Paxful, Ray, he's doing some cool things.
Yeah, totally.
You know, there's a lot that, and of course, you know, I would love to, you know, if I have enough projects, hire as many people as I could in Bitcoin, you know. Bitcoin, like 10 cents at a time.
Yeah. I saw that. And you got a very lovely donation from the football player.
Yeah, that's right. So he's a NFL player who, I think last year he said, you know, I'm going to take 13 million of my salary, you know, and half of it I'm going to put into Bitcoin. So he actually gets paid his, like, payroll, and it took some time for the NFL to do this. They're now paying half of his salary in Bitcoin. And I think
that's amazing.
Strike and some other companies are involved in kind of the back end of how that happens. So he gave a donate. And I don't take donations from people just because I'm not a charity. Like, I do this for fun. Like, I'm drawing attention to it. I'm pleading for the Ethiopian government to pay attention, right?
Yeah.
And to tax me. I'm like, guys, I'm making Bitcoin all day, every day. You got to tax me. You know?
Yeah. I dare you. Tax me. You're probably the only person who's asking for a tax.
In a digital wallet. Because also, like, you know, I've been challenging them to say that I'll make donations to the Ethiopian government if they'll accept it in Bitcoin. Right. And so they haven't responded yet. So it's literally just money sitting that they could take advantage of. Right. They can even sell the Bitcoin if they don't want it. Right. And so, you know, this is my way of talking directly to the government.
But they don't seem, they don't seem to have said, like, no outright to Bitcoin. In the report that you sent to me, they talked about, what was the term they used? Use cases, or they referred to, like, BitPesa, and they referred in their digital transformation strategy, they referred to using existing systems or leveraging those existing systems, which does include Bitcoin. So it kind of seems like they're kind of warming up to it.
Absolutely. No, they're warm to it. They'll, I think they'll adopt within their own, on their own grounds, and with the Ethiopian interest at mind. I'm sure they'll have some sort of telecom play, like Ethio Telecom, you know, is so far the monopoly provider. You know, they've invited in some competition and some new investors. So, you know, one of those investors are going to get involved for sure. And then they'll find a way to work with the Bitcoin and the local currency, right?
Yeah.
How do they transact among the two? Is one a settlement layer? Is one a transaction layer? You know, are they pegged in any way? Or, you know, so all of those discussions, you know, reams of people at the National Bank are going to have consultants. They want to open up the markets. All the banks are going to want to talk about this. It's a big achievement when it's done, but it has to get done. And in the meantime, I'm very impatient.
Which is, it's a good attribute to have.
I'm patient, but I'm not patient. So
Take advantage of that before you have kids, because then your time is no longer your own. You can't be like 24/7 all the time. You have to say, okay, let me schedule. Anyways, I digress because I'm still a new mom, but enjoy the fact that you're so driven and you have the time resources to be.
How old is your daughter?
She'll be 2 in October. So she was born in October, and we went into lockdown in, I want to say, March. So that's 5 months. 5 months and then lockdown, which is nice because we're both at home working. And so, like, we pick her up from daycare. We spend a lot of time with her on the weekends. Like, we dedicate most of our attention to her. She has a very strong sense of self. She's very confident. And my fear is that she thinks that this is normal. And why wouldn't she, right? Because she, like, this is her reality right now, so.
Yeah. No, I think for me, it's I've had a lot of, let's say, free time. So, and also, you know, so now it's become the case where, you know, maybe if we talked a year ago, right, or 2 years ago, you know, Bitcoin wasn't really on my radar, and now it's become my life. So it's turned into a lot, and I you know, at some point I'm gonna have to, like, because you've seen the way I manage some of those rooms and discussions, and maybe I should ask you, you know, what do you think of it? You know, I'm really curious as to, you know, what people think of kind of the brand and Bitcoin Blair and Bitcoin Nakfa, and maybe kind of like your perspective from, you know, either Trinidad and Tobago, you know, maybe your Swiss background. So what, I don't know, tell me about your kind of view of Bitcoin Blair.
My view is, so firstly, I think that I'm learning more than I'm actually contributing to it, because I see everyone giving their addresses and stuff, and I see the onboarding process, and I think I see part of your strategy, which is to try to expose as many people as possible to Bitcoin. And then, in all honesty, I don't have time to read the thousands of Telegram messages that come through on a regular basis. So I find myself, like, going to the group maybe once a week or twice a week, looking at Twitter. I think your Twitter game is very strong. Well, this coming from a person who's got like 50 followers, because I just can't dedicate a lot of time there. But you're always tagging people. You're always posting things that I feel are relevant and things that will draw more and more people in. So I think that you're doing very well. And I'm actually very, like, impressed by the level of energy and attention that you're giving to this.
Thank you. So yeah, that was the mission. That was the objective, to just put a lot of heart into it. And you know, I think you've noted that a lot of you know, OGs have taken notice and support.
Oh yeah.
You know, and you know, said, how can we donate, and you know, what do we need to do? And moving forward, it's going to be. I think it's not going to take money. It's going to take just time for it to naturally into a conversation. That group has grown to almost 400 people. And the only real objective of Bitcoin Blair and Bitcoin Nakfa at this time is for people to learn how to operate a Lightning wallet and 10 cents in their wallet. You know, if you can get,
that's amazing,
10% of the population to do that, then like, first it's going to be kind of like forcing it, right? Because they're going, what is this? Like, Bitcoin?
But I don't see it like your mom.
and actually that's also kind of a strategic play. So during my mother's youth, sugar was still kind of a novel item. It was new in Ethiopia, right? So they didn't know it. They you know, and so I don't want to date my mother, but maybe a little older than my mother. And so what the emperor did was, after he set up sugar factories, right, to produce sugar, because there were sugar canes, so might as well manufacture it and and sell it at a profit, right? He realized nobody was, you know, nobody knew what sugar was, right? And so he asked the corporation to, and I'm not sure who's doing marketing for them, but they're a genius. They would put, you know, 10 cents worth of sugar in a kind of a little plastic bag, like a Ziploc, right?
Yeah.
And they would give it out for free, right? And so it's just as many people as and so people are like, oh, what is, they'll put in their coffee, they'll put in their tea, it's, you know, tasty. And today, we actually have to import sugar because the sugar factories don't produce enough sugar, right?
The demand is that high.
Demand is that high, you know? So.
But honey in Ethiopia is amazing.
What was that?
Honey in Ethiopia is amazing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are tons of natural. I'm not saying the product is right, right?
Yeah.
I'm just saying their marketing is on point. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Point taken. Point taken.
I would prefer that a lot of those, you know, sugars leave Ethiopia. And, you know.
Point taken.
Their marketing is so, yeah, 10 cents for any person in that group. If they can manage that 10 cent, and send it somewhere or do this and
yep.
Then that's enough. They know more about Bitcoin and they know the difference between Bitcoin and Satoshi, right? A lot of people I talk to still don't know that difference. So it's kind of hard to, you know, explain.
It's a process. Actually, you know, you asked me about like from a Swiss or Trinidad and Tobago perspective. And it just occurred to me, are you familiar with Jamaican culture?
Jerk chicken and, you know, beautiful food and beautiful kind of, you know, musical.
Music, dance hall, yeah.
Absolutely. And, yeah, so that's...
Rastafari?
Ethiopians have a huge kind of community of Rastafarians living in...
Shashamane, right?
Yeah, Shashamane. Absolutely.
Yeah. And just like, this is probably, it just came to mind. So it's nothing sort of thought out or strategic or anything. But from that perspective, I think there is like a percentage of Jamaican Rastafaris who actually like make it somewhat of a priority in life to visit Ethiopia, the land of Haile Selassie, as they say. And so from a tourist perspective or from a Bitcoin perspective, maybe there's something there. I have no idea because I'm not too familiar with the monetary system in Jamaica, but it's just something, you know, to keep in mind if like something comes up.
Absolutely. No, there's a huge connection between those shared histories, as well as the histories of, you know, there's, I would say, a lot of Rastafarians in the Bitcoin community, and...
Wait. There are Rastafarians in the Bitcoin community?
That is right.
I need to tell my sister. Sorry. My sister is, like, in love with Jamaican culture. Like, you would hear her speak, and you would swear that she's, like, born and raised. Thank you for that.
It'll do that to you. I mean, they have, so, okay, my first experience with kind of Rastafarian cultures, so I grew up in San Jose, California.
Yeah.
And, you know, the closest University of California was Santa Cruz, right? And so, and their campus is all along the mountain trail, right? So it goes up.
Yeah.
And there's, like, 9 or 10 schools, and so all within the mountains are these kind of communities. And so
yeah,
in the mountains, you actually have Rastafarians just camping out and living out.
Yeah, yeah.
And
vegetarian. Yep.
There and see in their behavior, they're very clean with their food, with you know, kind of very holy and how they
yeah.
themselves and they address themselves and very, you know, clean eating, clean living. And this thesis of, well, you know, there's clean money, you know, untapped government, no wars involved, you know, there's some Satoshi guy, we don't know who he is, he started it and left, you know, and probably some pothead, right? And so just kind of built all of these things to where, you know, those two things will really communicate with each other. And so, you know, my good mentor, Oflo, he's actually a rapper, you know, Bobo Dread, you know, he's inviting me down all the time, and he's saying, look, you know, this is, you know, the most sovereign thing, you know, right? And all of those things type. So, you know, I'm kind of a money nerd. I collect currency. My brother has currency, and then I'll take it from my brother. But and so we have all these old currencies that back in the day you couldn't find, right? They weren't really available to people. And so you have the history of kind of the Maria Theresa dollar in Ethiopia, which is gold and silver bullion. And then you have the British pound come, and they try to manipulate the Ethiopian kind of currencies and cash notes. And then there's the history of, you have the Italians come and a few years try to insert their dominance. And then, of course, you have the collapse of the gold standard in the U.S. in 71, which brought everything crashing down. So, and Haile Selassie was very smart in his approach, because he would accept the proposals from the British, he would read them, and they would try to, this is his Imperial Majesty, right? So this is the...
Yes.
The infamous.
I visited the university in his former residence.
That's right.
Yeah.
His former residence, and he donated to the university. And he was actually the Minister of Education for several years, because he thought it was such an important position. He can't just entrust it to anyone. I have to do it myself, you know?
Yeah.
But his tie to money, to actual gold and silver, is really strong. And as the British were coming in with these proposals, you know, it's well documented. Befakadu Daggafe, he's a scholar, historian, economist. He writes about money, and he writes, you know, clearly about, you know, about these histories, and how he would respond, and the different tricks that the salesman, the money salesman would. They would say, oh, let's call it the Haile dollar, you know? And we're going to build you a brand new currency. And at some point, they were trying to have it be divisible by the East African shilling, right? Which would have had, like, one East African shilling be, like, I think it was 2,000 Ethiopian birr, right? So debasing it from the start, right?
Yeah.
Because they had already built such a stronghold in Kenya. And so... you see these nefarious actors come from all walks, right? And Haile Selassie, you know, I mean, as much as that history went south, and, you know, we had communism, and then, you know, nothing better kind of follow for decades. It's one thing that the Rastafarian community and the Ethiopian community share. Their value, for intrinsic value, and either it's going to be in your sovereignty, your health, or your natural money, you know?
But I'd like to know, in your process of onboarding people through Bitcoin Burr and Bitcoin Nakfa, do you notice that, I have to ask this question, does, like, gender, religious belief, like, any of these dimensions of diversity get in the way of people understanding Bitcoin or people's ability to use Bitcoin or Satoshis?
I don't think so. Because it cuts across all of these, you know, different boxes, you know?
Yep.
So I guess from my own experience, like, I can see from the Bitcoin Burr kind of traffic and audience that somewhere. So in the beginning, about 29% of our audience were women, and then that grew to 39%, but only because we targeted women and tried to, like, you know. So when you do the advertising, you can say, like, you know, male, female, and then geography and all of that. So we would click on the box that said like female, 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 you know? And so right now we're at 39% women, right? If anything, women are going to be even more of a support for Bitcoin, right? Because they're real, you know, they take care of households, right? They're entrepreneurs. They have many different assignments, and you know, they accomplish them well, and you know, a lot of consumer goods are and decisions are done by the woman. So, I think in some things like that, you know, Bitcoin will have an advantage. There might be some groups that are, you know, like any new technology or any new solution, there's going to be laggards. Pioneers and you know, all of advocates, and it'll just kind of naturally develop. But I wouldn't say that it's been a, you know, we'll see. We'll see how it all develops.
We'll see. And in Ethiopia, like in some other regions, do you see a lot of women who are entrepreneurs? Women who make things, weave things?
Yes. So, I mean, the economy as a whole, you know, if you look at, their size of it, you know, most of it is agriculture. Most of it is kind of in the rural areas. And then you have kind of a push by the government to incentivize manufacturing, right?
Yeah.
And this, of course, includes easy to assemble items. It might include different cottonware and canvases, and some of the textile giants are now working in Ethiopia.
Oh yeah,
So H&M, you know, through partners and this and that, and a PVH Corporation. So you know, those things will continue to grow, but you know, most of the population still doesn't have access to those type of jobs. Still doesn't have access to a smartphone or kind of basic kind of banking facilities. So, you know, it's going to be an interest. So, you know, the Bitcoin discussion always comes secondary to the telecom discussion in Ethiopia.
Yeah, yep.
That's why I was so interested late last night when I got the Deloitte report. And they're, you know, talking about privatization of telecom and how it's going to play out and why the industry is... it's fruitful and all of this, and some of those numbers, you know, there's a lot expected. You know, there needs to be a lot of capital. There needs to be some good partners go in, because as of now, you know, we can't fully adopt all of Ethiopia into Bitcoin because not everybody has a smartphone in their pocket.
You know? Yeah, and as you say, it's not even about Bitcoin. It's really about the infrastructure.
Yeah, that, and I guess you could work through they call it mesh networks. And SMS technology, like that does exist. You can develop on it. And also, you know, one doesn't have to come before the other, really, because there are 300-400 people in that group now. They're all learning. They're like the early pioneers, right? They're like, hey, what's this about? Like, give me 10 cents, you know? And so they're going to have it. They're going to think it's silly or whatever. They'll learn about it. Like, you know, as this thing becomes more talked about, they'll kind of go back to it, right? And I guess also, and you know, this would probably take me into a different strategy, or maybe, you know, I would need more help, and you know, I bring on more people and advisors. But you know, if this thing is about learning, is Telegram really the right channel for that? You know.
Yeah. Good point.
So you know, Instagram is working okay, but you know, maybe there needs to be some sort of full-fledged website, right? Or some application, or some PDF guide, right? And I mean, the mission in all of this is to keep it like free.
Open source, because it is Bitcoin. Yeah.
Because you know, I would hate to charge somebody a few, you know, nickels to like teach them about money. You know what I mean? Like that seems unfair. Like it's gold, you know what I mean? It's not going to go anywhere. Like,
yeah,
you know, you should get a little some of it. You should learn about it and then go about your day, you know?
Yeah.
if this thing could be free, open source, people can contribute, that's, you know, that's the idea behind it.
Yeah. Well, like previously, I did an episode with Ashley Chen. She created a website called Bitcoin Wisdom for Busy People. It is like, basically, it's curated with so many Bitcoin resources. It's available in English and traditional Chinese. So if there are English speakers in the group, I would direct them to that website because it has a wealth of information centralized, ironically, a wealth of information available in one place.
Perfect, perfect. We'll and you know, it's so interesting to see because, and we'll pull those resources and I'll put it on the Telegram, I'll put it on the website and, you know, anything else that follows. And, you know, it's, and so you said her name is Ms. Chan, you said?
Ashley Chen, and the website is bitcoinwisdomforbusypeople.com. I'll send you the link.
Perfect, perfect. And I've heard you know, most of her podcast with you, and yeah, it's just really surprising to see a lot of my, I guess you can say, like advisors or mentors are actually women. You know, so I
really
yeah, and it's the case with you. It's the case with you know, people in Ethiopia, just, you know, they'll usually send a question and it kind of evolves into, okay, read this and do this, you know? And then it also tends to be the very, like when you look at, you talked about BitPesa, right?
Yeah.
The founder is a woman, you know, Elizabeth.
No way. Ah.
I'm forgetting her last name, but Elizabeth. Not to be confused with Elizabeth Stark, who also is the co-founder of Lightning Labs, right?
Yep.
So they're the ones building the kind of the network and the second layer, and it makes, you know, what I'm sending instant and, you know, pretty much no fees, right?
Yep.
And so you know, and even within the Ethiopian side, so it's always, you know, so maybe in numbers you would think men beat out, right? And I did talk about that, those numbers earlier, you know, 29%, 39% are, but the women that are involved are really involved. They're actually leading, you know?
Yeah.
So that digital strategy report, the national one from Ethiopia that you were reading, most of it was developed by, I don't want to say her name because I don't know how you know, close she wants to be to the project, but she's a very well-respected woman within, you know, kind of the digital industry in Ethiopia. And and so a lot of the kind of the, you know, going back to your question, you know, where is the Ethiopian government in this? I am confident that at least some of the decision makers will be women, because Dr. Abiy, or Prime Minister, half of his cabinet is made up of women, right?
Yep.
So, and of course, Bitcoin touches every sector. So, you know, and our president, you know, I had a chance to meet the president of Ethiopia.
Oh, wow.
Zode. And she is, you know, beautiful lady. And, you know, she has a wealth of kind of diplomatic experiences. And she comes from a Francophone background. And you know, it's going to be these women that make those decisions of, where does Bitcoin come into the play? Can it provide any type of value? You know, how do we sync it with our existing organizations? And so, yeah, I mean, you know, it's actually been a very pleasant, you know, normally you work in industries or you're in offices and in decision-making groups, and you can see that some of those actors are not representative, right, of kind of the larger picture, right?
Yep.
I've seen this in a lot of my work background, right? I've worked with a lot of these government offices and, you know, large organizations, right? And it's, you know, you kind of leave the room feeling, all right, you know, there was another missed opportunity. There was some segment that wasn't addressed, you know? But thankfully, within this, you know, little Bitcoin community, a lot of the counterparts, at least on the Ethiopia side, I think will kind of slowly envelop this, and women have really been leading the day on this.
For me, in my like learning journey about Bitcoin, one thing, so besides the fact that I'm absolutely fascinated that Bitcoin has no leader, yet so many different types of people are drawn to it, I'm also, I almost feel like this sense of relief because everything is open source. I love to read, and I can access so many articles, so many pieces of information. Like, I think it was 2 years ago, I audited a class on edx.com or something like that with, through the University of California, Berkeley. And it was like a basic Bitcoin course describing what this thing is, how it works. And so I don't know how familiar you are with diversity and inclusion and what barriers to inclusion are and how they're how they look for the average person going about their business. One barrier is access to information. So basically, not everyone has access to the same information, which means that not everyone has the ability to make sound or holistic decisions because they're only given bits and bytes of info. And with Bitcoin, through so many people like donating their time, driven by passion and driven by hope, I would say, there's information available to anyone who has time, the mental, I guess, capacity, the patience, access to the internet. Of course, that is something that still needs to be worked on. But for the most part, so long as you can access the internet and you're humble enough to acknowledge that you need to learn, you can learn. And so for me as a woman, you know, I've like, you know, I have my undergrad degree. I went to business school. I did another certificate program at Cornell. Like, I've been in school for a very long time. I've worked in various environments. I've traveled a lot. This is the first thing for me where I feel that I can learn as much as I want, and I'm only restrained by my time and my daughter, but that's like, but that's different. And so I think, I can't speak for other women, but I think that for people who historically have been somewhat discouraged from pursuing things or who have, I don't know, for whatever reason, been denied access to things, discovering Bitcoin is like discovering freedom.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's, you know, that's the thesis. And there still need to be some things that happen like on the ground, right? Because as my mother noted, it's in the sky, right?
Yeah.
You know, that's all and good. But on the ground where you actually have to work with people, you have to
be
to the bank manager, right? Yeah, to get that local currency or, you know, you have to barter at those markets and who's allowed in those markets. And, you know, the Bitcoin story is, I think, a good one, but also it's going to be one where we really have to kind of work on other things too.
Yeah.
To see it come to fruition, you know? And maybe one good thing to mention is, you know, a few weeks ago, everyone was talking about energy, right? Oh, you know, clean energy, dirty energy. What is energy? Carbon credits, right? And you know, to be honest, those are good discussions, right? How do we have, you know, a renewable, clean, non-hazardous, safe energy, right? Affordable energy. Can we use geothermal energy or volcanic, you know? You know, I think Bitcoin will help a lot of industries innovate because it's going to be really lucrative to solve these questions. If you can solve the energy problem, then you can, you know, you mine more Bitcoin, you know? And then also if we have so many of these linkages destroyed, and when I say linkages, I don't say them in any good, when I say linkages, I mean brokers and agents, you know, the middlemen, right?
The middle people,
They're usually like six or seven middlemen, really, like when you count. Like, so count the people or the organizations So if you were to send me, you know, $50 from Switzerland to from now in Texas, you know, how many different organizations does that touch and do, or, you know, people need to approve, right? And you know, especially international, right?
Oh, yeah. I've had my experiences between, even between Canada and Switzerland. I'm like, really, a week? Like, why does it have to take this long? Yeah.
And so, and then when you are a minority, right? And, you know, sometimes it's hard for me to speak about, like, one identity because I'm you know, very Ethiopian. But also, my neighbors in Eritrea are equally of me, you know, my African, you know, everyone. And then you go to the islands, you know, and come everywhere, right? So but even within my, it's that freedom and that ability to place your bet, you know, whenever you'd like, and no one can touch that. And so when it gets to minority communities, when it gets to women, whether they're, you know, I can't speak to that, right? But I assume that they're going to be more empowered.
Well, I hope you guys enjoyed the episode. I had a lot of fun speaking with Cal, and I still chuckle when I think of his airport story. And, you know, I can just imagine his mother looking up and asking, where is it? Where is Bitcoin? But Cal's firsthand experience is just showing how Bitcoin is helping to foster financial inclusion in Ethiopia and Eritrea. If you'd like to learn more, visit bitcoinburr.org or bitcoinburr on GitHub. And Burr is spelled B-I-R-R. For socials, you can find Cal at Cal Kassa, and that's spelled K-A-L-K-A-S-S-A, and at Bitcoin Burr, and again, Burr is spelled B-I-R-R, and at Bitcoin NACFA, and NACFA is spelled N-A-K-F-A. You may also sign a change.org petition called Bitcoin Tender for Ethiopia. And I finally created a Foster Inclusion Twitter account. Find me at F Inclusion. That sounds pretty funny. F Inclusion. Okay, haha. But it's F-I-N-C-L-U-S-I-O-N. We'll call it Finclusion. You can find me at Finclusion. All links, socials, websites, and other materials referenced in our conversation will be included in the show notes. Bye!